Freedom News Hour with Jake Towns, Walt Thiessen, and Gene DiNardo, Thursdays at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on Progressive Radio Network.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds.
It's the Freedom News Hour Surviving Meltdown, and I'm your host, Walt Thiessen, here with my co-hosts, Jake Towns and Gene DiNardo, here on this Thursday, September 22nd, 2008. Oh, did I say 2008? Must be because it feels like what was happening 3 years ago this week when Lehman Brothers failed, because the banks are at it again. They are in trouble, particularly over in Europe. Here in 2011, are we facing the next banking crisis? Well, we've been talking about it a lot here on the Freedom News Hour. We'll be talking about it more today. The IMF chief, Christine Lagarde, today said, quote, this is the Guardian headline in the United Kingdom, you must bail out the banks again. Managing director of the IMF urged Europe's leaders to bail out their fragile banks, says the newspaper, as the boss of the Eurozone's biggest bank, BNP Paribas, rejected fears that the financial sector is in peril. She went on to say it is critical that to fuel growth, banks must be in a position to finance the economy, to finance enterprises, to finance households, to finance local governments. To do that, they need to have the balance sheet that will actually support credit to the economy. Well, more and more fear coming and more trepidation coming. Interesting thing, though, this time it's happening primarily over in Europe, not so much here. It's a different perspective this time, although the markets aren't taking it very well, are they, Jake?
Oh, no, and, you know, the name of our show, Surviving Meltdown, is no more apt than, like, a day like today. The Dow and the S&P were down 3 and 4% at times each day. Really, kind of the only thing that went up was a little bit was the dollar index by 1.5%. Gold was down, but not as much as most people would think. It was down about $60, or that probably works out to, like, a couple percent, 2 or 3%. So, murder in the stock market hopefully hurts the folks on Wall Street, although knowing most people's luck, a lot of them were already short knowing what the Fed was going to be pulling off.
And there was quite a run-up in the Dow this week and in markets in general, actually not this week, but over the past few weeks, but the last couple of days, those have all taken a hit today. You know, the market down, what, almost 400 points, actually it was over 400 points at one point, 3.5% drop, and reflecting what's going on around the world in markets. Everybody, once again, flooding back to the dollar, sort of like the horse running into the burning barn. But they're going to keep doing that because the general economic tenor of virtually, what, I wouldn't say everyone's beliefs, or perhaps a majority of the beliefs of the major traders on the planet, they're all Keynesians. They all believe that the dollar is going to be the safest place to go, and there's nothing really to change that at this point because they haven't really grasped the idea that we need solid money, do they?
Well, the thing is, when people are rushing for dollars, they'll quickly find that there's only so many dollars out there, too. And, like, we have to remember the main thing that's generating this downturn is fear. In the Fed minutes that came out yesterday that precipitated this whole sell-off, the main thing that traders saw on that was the quote that, quote, there are significant downside risks to the economic outlook, including strains in the global financial markets. The committee also anticipates that inflation will settle over coming quarters at levels at or below, consistent with the committee's dual mandate, as the effects of past energy and other commodity price increases dissipate further, unquote. And what's very interesting to see, and what they ended up deciding to do was that they're going to have kind of a sterilized, what they call Operation Twist, where they're going to be selling $400 billion of Treasury securities with maturities of 6 to 30 years. So, in other words, the longer-term Treasury securities, and they're going to sell the short-term securities in an equal amount back into the market of 3 years or less. And the whole idea is it's going to kind of do two things, and so far it has worked, you know, after 24 hours. It's worked kind of the way that they thought it would. It's put downward pressure on longer-term interest rates. And and what that's done is it really is just another word for saying it's making it easier for the federal government to borrow money. By using the Fed to sterilize it, you know, provided people's faith in the dollar remains. And the second thing that it does is, and what could happen is it could free up a lot of these reserves at the banks, because the banks are going to be the sellers to the Fed. They, of course, are going to make out fairly well. And any other bond vigilantes that's, you know, following what the Fed does, you just follow what they do and do the exact opposite, and you can make a profit. And, you know, what the government's doing, and, you know, today what came out, you know, on a lot of the commodities, they're precipitating kind of a drop in these, because China came out with news today that the major industrial commodity, copper, that they aren't consuming nearly as much as in the past, and copper plummeted like about 70 cents from $4 to $3.30, and that's huge. That's like over 20%. And a lot of stocks were down, you know, between 3% and 20% even on the day. A lot of the banks were down themselves. But again, what the government's doing is they're trying to save the banks and keep them solvent. And, you know, there's really kind of nothing new in, nothing new with that.
They're not going to keep them solvent. I mean, they can't keep the banks solvent because the banks have so many losses that are just hanging over them that it's just ridiculous how much lost revenue, I can't call it revenue, how much lost capital there is in, on those balance sheets, and that's why the balance sheets are looking so bad to the market. Plus, this
right.
is tried.
Where the banks are at is they can just create deposits, and that's what you're going to end up seeing. And, you know, the Fed decision that came out, what's also very interesting was they had, you know, like we talked about on our show earlier, they had a two-day session, which is unusual. And at the end of the day, they didn't really announce anything that the market was expecting. You know, the interest rates were, the Fed funds rate is remaining near zero. But they still had the same three dissenters, from the last month. So it was not a unanimous decision. And, one just has to say, you know, Bernanke was either probably pushing for something more like QE3, or, you know, what's also pretty likely is they probably knew about the copper news coming out of China. They probably knew kind of what would happen when they put out this press release. What they could end up causing is, you know, what ends up happening is, you know, the Dow plunges, you know, today 3-4%. Let's say it goes down another 10%, 15%, 20%. People are going to be screaming, and at that point, it'll become politically expedient for the Fed to release QE3. So if that's their intent, maybe that's going to be something that's going to occur in the, you know, next month even.
Well, of course, this Operation Twist is something that they tried 40 years ago back in the 1960s, and it absolutely failed completely. So I guess the question in my mind is, why do they think it's going to succeed this time? I don't really see how it does succeed, because it's not like the banks don't have any liquidity. They got plenty of liquidity. What they have is a pile of losses, and
exactly.
These losses are just so huge that, I mean, there's not enough money in the system yet to cover all those losses, although the Fed's doing their damnedest to try to give them that much money, but nevertheless, there's not enough money to cover all these losses, which are gigantic, and I think that's probably what's really showing up here, despite the fact that the banks have been portrayed to us as being financially healthy and so forth. They've got tons of losses that they just haven't written off, primarily because they don't actually have to account for those losses mark to market.
And I'm really surprised they rely on their balance sheets at all, to tell you the truth.
That's a good point, Gene.
I mean, do they really have to when you think about it? Maybe like, Jake, you mentioned market pressure, but the other interesting thing about the market is with so much electronic trading these days, and, you know, it's a phenomenal percentage of all the markets, but I think especially the American markets, is, you know, how do they program these machines? Do they program in, okay, if you hear any news of, you know, Greece, any news about Greece, sell.
I think it's significant to note that the floor of the New York Stock Exchange no longer has traders on it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's all computers. I mean, they still have the ritual of ringing the bell to end the session, but anybody ringing that bell is looking down on an empty floor that's just basically full of machines. There are no people down there.
Yeah, and if you can get, if you have any space, I read this, if any space close to Wall Street where the actual stock market is, the closer it is, it's just an incredible, you know, you'll just get millions and millions of dollars of this, because that's where they want the computers. They want the computers as close as possible to the ticker, and, you know, I guess, you know, a matter of a few yards can make a difference. So they just go crazy over that real estate, even crazier than they did before.
Right, and they're kind of competing with that real estate these days, because over the weekend, a program called Occupy Wall Street launched, where you had up to 1,000 people at One Liberty Plaza, facing down a whole bunch of riot police near the NYPD. About 400 to 500 have continued to camp out there for the last several days. They're still there, and they've called it, you know, the Day of Rage. And what's quite a, you know, I have my sympathies because obviously they're very upset at all these bankers stealing money from them. But at the same time, I think they're somewhat uninformed because, you know, part of their demands that are listed on OccupyWallStreet.org include such things as ending wealth inequality. You know, it's a good thing, but how do you go about it? They want to ending joblessness is a demand. You know, how do you go about it? Ending poverty is a demand. Ending the health profiteering. You know, they stated on their website today that there's 50 million Americans without health insurance is one demand. But there's a lot of things I do agree with. Like they have called for an end to the wars abroad and an end to the military bases in, you know, 150 plus of the, pretty much every country that we can possibly have in the world has an American military base, and to close all those. Those are just kind of like common sense, you know, not that Congress doesn't follow common sense. But yeah, if you go to the website, they have other things like, you know, their agenda includes today, they're having a teach-in on the Communist Manifesto, and tomorrow they're having a talk on the history of socialism and how to tax millionaires. But I think they're kind of going about it the wrong way because, you know, we cover this, what happens when you try to go after people that create wealth. Like in the state of Maryland, the state of Maryland tried to go after the millionaires with a income tax, and what happened? They either stopped making money or they just disappeared. So,
well, yeah, you know, the wealth have such, the wealthy have such a grasp on the financial system, you know, not all the wealthy, but any law, I mean, the whole Obama thing where he's saying, and I'm not really sure, was he actually raising the upper rate on, you know, millionaires or over 250,000, but, you know, I read one thing where there was over 2,000 millionaires who don't pay any taxes, not millionaires, there was over 2,000 people who earn an income $1 million a year and don't pay any taxes. Now, I think the rate should actually be lower, and you know, there's got to be a way to eliminate, if you're going to have an income tax, there's got to be a way to eliminate people who earn $1 million in income and don't pay taxes, isn't there?
Well, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think they're actually earning that in the form of capital gains.
Well,
which is why it's not covered by the income tax. So I may be wrong, but
capital
gains.
You're probably right,
yeah,
and that's another thing where you're going to classify incomes differently. I don't understand that.
Well, I don't either, but that's what they do.
Right. It's like, okay, why don't we just lower the rates and classify all income the same? Isn't that a more just, if income tax can actually be just? And that's a question I definitely would argue on the side that it could never be just. Still, if you're going to do that, why do you tax these different, you know, types of income differently?
You were going to say something, Jake, before
I'll... Oh, yeah, I was going to add, you know, the whole thing that this is kind of predicated upon is that Obama has stated that, you know, the tax that Warren Buffett has called for to be reinstated in the upcoming Committee of 12 or whatever, the super committee. And the whole idea is they're going to go after people that make over $1 million a year. So by doing that, he hopes to shield, you know, he kind of doesn't have to worry about 98% of the population. You know, it's a nice little class warfare because, you know, most people aren't going to complain except for the millionaires, and they're going to go after them to try and get them to pay as much as if it were regular earnings. So they're going to, you know, drive up the tax rate on that to 35% or higher. And,
well,
you know,
that was his proposal to drive up the tax rate above $1 million then.
Right, and the thing is, they have to realize what's going to occur. You know, it's pretty simple, and you can argue whether or not, because, you know, obviously a lot of these bankers that are getting their earnings and bonuses from these fake deposits that they're allowed to create and are taking advantage of the system, you know, it's really income that is, you know, gotten with the help and assistance of the government more than anything else.
Right.
You know, that's not very good income. But, you know, there are general, you know, a lot of small business owners and stuff that are working hard. You know, what's going to happen if they see, okay, you know, I'm going to take a 35% loss on everything. Why should they work hard to try and, you know, increase the amount if it's all going to get taken away from them? So... What's probably going to end up doing, if they do pass it, is that it would just be something that, you know, it's going to create more joblessness because they're not going to be out there creating firms and opportunities for people to work. And it's going to further drop, like, the whole, it's going to worsen the depression is my my view on it.
You know, you mentioned the protesters down on Liberty Street there near Wall Street, and how they want to have you know, more jobs. They want to have the unemployment rate come down. They want to have all these things happen that are good things to happen for the economy. And yet, as you point out, their solutions are less than desirable, and they have this Marxist tendency. It's interesting to me that they don't pay any attention to some of what their own leaders have written about the monetary system. Because,
well, yeah, including Karl Marx.
Including,
right?
Karl Marx, that's right. Because if they actually looked at the monetary system, they might understand what it's going to take to achieve all those goals.
That's
because really,
great.
That's the root of the problem. When you have an unstable, changing monetary system, particularly one that is accelerating in size, you're going to end up with all kinds of catastrophic events happening. Everything from inflation to recession to everything in between, just because the monetary system is unstable and everybody's chasing that monetary system. Have a level, stable monetary system, you get a completely different economic situation. You get the kind of prosperity that they're looking for. You get the kind of equalization that they're looking for, just because that's the way a market works under a level, stable money supply. Yet they don't seem to get that. I don't understand why.
I think Jake mentioned that they don't understand it. I think you mentioned that. And I think that's true because I've talked to people, you know, on the left. And the other thing that they don't understand is they're trying to, you know, they're rebelling against a coercive system, but they're trying to institute another coercive system. And, you know, that'll eventually, systems that are imposed by force fail. I mean, they always do. So, you know, and we've seen the Russian socialist system, and, you know, China is somewhat of a socialist capitalist, state capitalist system. But, people eventually rebel against force, and you put in this Marxist system, and it's just gonna, you know, people are gonna get fed up with it and try to work around it and eventually get rid of it. So I don't think they understand that either, but that's a great point you bring up.
Yeah, and I shouldn't say that Marx and Lenin and so forth were hard money types. They weren't, but at least they seem to understand the monetary system better than their own supporters do.
Yeah, like, yeah. I said, what's interesting, and I think what's also worth paying some attention to is, like, from the website, the New York Police Department has been pretty much putting a beat down on some of these peaceful protesters, like forcibly dragging them and beating them with sticks and that sort of thing. So, one of the things that Barack Obama has said in the past, that what essentially sets a nation state apart is a monopoly on violence. You know, I make a joke that, you know, they're kind of finding that out the hard way.
Yeah.
But when you take a look at the Communist Manifesto, and these protesters actually have a focus group on it this evening, if they go through it and take a look at, you know, some of the planks, like, for instance, a central bank that controls all the money. Uh-huh. Well, we have that right now.
Yeah.
And you might, you know, be asked to, you know, if you were an honest intellectual and you look at this, you'd be like, well, you know, that's you already have that, number one, so that's not really, it could be the problem itself.
Well,
yeah.
Maybe they see it as an easier transition.
Right.
We already have it, you know, so.
Oh, dear. Well, meanwhile, of course, this continues to wreak havoc on the economy, as despite all the claims by the media that things are looking a little bit better and so forth, the actual picture for the typical American continues to be worse and worse, and we're seeing it particularly where individuals are ranked compared to, say, corporations, because the corporations are growing richer and the Americans are growing poorer. And, Gene, I know you have some details about that.
Yeah, this is, we've covered this before, but this is a report that just came out for spring, and it said the Americans overall, their wealth declined this spring for the first time in a year as stocks and home values fell. At the same time, corporations increased their stockpiles of cash. So we're seeing the same thing. Banks, you know, as bad as their balance sheets are, they have stockpiles of cash, as they usually do anyway, and corporations are the same in this situation. The combination could slow an already weak economy, because it suggests families have less to spend and businesses are reluctant to expand at a time when consumers are already struggling with high unemployment and meager pay raises. Household net worth dropped 0.3% to $58.5 trillion, that's overall, in the April-June quarter, according to a Federal Reserve report released last Friday. That followed three straight quarterly increases. I don't think this factors in inflation, though, with those increases. The value of American stock portfolios fell 0.5%, and it probably fell even more today, and home values dropped 0.4%. Corporations held a record $2 trillion in cash at the end of June, an increase of 4.5% from January-March quarter. So, you know, it's funny because, you know, the banks and, you know, the big mega corporations got the money, and the working people going to work don't have any. It's like, what's wrong here?
Right, and I think one of the outcomes of this, you know, the 2008 panic, and I think what we have going on right now is quite a bit different than that 2008 panic. You had a drive in 2008 to mainly treasury bonds, and people that wrote it out either in cash or treasury bonds made out pretty well. This time around, at least, you know, for the first bit, I think that the more physical cash, I don't mean, you know, bank account cash, but the actual physical cash you have, and then other hard assets such as, you know, gold, for instance. You know, gold, even though the markets were down quite a bit, gold and, you know, a lot of these industrial commodities like copper got slaughtered down, you know, 20% or so. Gold itself was only down about 3%, and still far above where it was even just a month ago. It's still like about $200 higher. So one of the things that people could do is, you know, take advantage of these downturns, because all it is investors liquidating their gold assets to go into cash so they can go back in and buy up some of these stocks quite a bit lower prices, and, you know, kind of take advantage of these drops.
Yeah, that's
just
true.
Like we had, you know, and the thing is, like, you know, with the news that came out and all the fear that's out there, the natural thing to do would be to go to gold. And what, you know, obviously the Fed knows this, and, you know, from all the things that we've seen with GATA and what we covered last week, when the Swiss franc pretty much said it was going to de facto peg itself to the euro and devalue and lost 10%. Really in several hours versus gold, you know, it's not certainly not past them to hit gold, you know, as these as this news is coming out, in order to keep people away from the very safe havens that'll save their bacon when, you know, the dollar goes up and the dollar devalues. Because, you know, the facts of the matter, you know, it's almost like Ben Bernanke and the Fed just skipped out on the latest press release, the August 2011 press release from the Bureau of Labor and Statistics, states that the consumer price index for all urban consumers increased 0.4% in 1 month. Which is a 3.8% annual adjustment. And we've kind of gotten into that, too. You know, the government, you know, wants this inflation to continue at rates higher than 2% for prolonged periods of time, because you know, makes their debt load seem quite a bit smaller. And you do 3 to 5% for a few years, and you are literally, in effect, defaulting, but on your debt, you're just, you know, paying out in dollars that aren't nearly worth as much.
Yeah, another
3.8% is a heck of a lot higher than a 10-year treasury right now, especially today.
Exactly. Another article I saw was, and I've seen numerous articles like this, you know, the housing market, the Fed should do more for the housing market to support prices and bring back housing inflation, because, you know, what we're feeling at one point during the boom, the housing economy, you know, just everybody who worked in repairing housing and all that and building housing was pushing almost 30% of the economy, you know, is a huge amount. And so they think if you reinflate the housing thing, you know, and people are going to go back to work and it's going to fix everything. And, you know, and nobody's saying, well, look, you know, these prices, these housing prices are actually getting close to more reasonable prices. You know, I mean, it's funny how people look at the economy. It's, you know, how to plan and to gear it and to get it to this place, you know, no matter what it does to the average person.
And Jake, you were mentioning a few minutes ago about how gold didn't get hit as hard as other commodities did. That may be in part because of a huge, huge floor, so to speak, that existed in the range of the 1700 to 1750 mark, and which is currently playing out because that's the range in which the gold is currently trading. Apparently, there are buyers for physical gold practically lined up, so to speak. Huge numbers of contracts that were just waiting for the price to come down to the 1700 to 1750 range, and they're starting to kick in now. And guess where most of these contracts are coming from? They're coming from Asia. They're coming from far, far away, people who are buying like crazy. Another thing that's interesting, of course, it's not just the United States that likes to give out contrary information. China is also very good at it. Saw two different articles that came out this past week, one of which said, the headline said, China to liquidate U.S. treasuries, not dollars. The other headline said, China to keep buying U.S. treasuries. It just depends who you listen to. The first report was based on a quote from one of the central bankers of China. The second was from the People's Daily, the official newspaper of the ruling Communist Party. So it makes you wonder which one to believe. My guess is that you could probably believe the banker a little bit more than the Chinese Communist Party, but I could be wrong. Jake, maybe you have a different reading on that.
Yeah, well, you know, I think some of the people that are buying, you know, the gold are the central banks, and they probably include, folks over in Asia, but pretty much everywhere. Central banks have turned into net buyers of gold. And there might be an even better reason for that, meaning, you know, they have to cover a lot of the gold that they have leased out in the marketplace.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, right.
And it's not just Asian banks either. European central banks have become net buyers for the first time in more than two decades. So, I mean, that just shows how turbulent the whole market has become because all the banks are pretending that gold is nothing. And what was it that Bernanke called it? It was like an ancient artifact. That's not what he said. That's the
tradition.
Thing.
He said it was tradition.
It was a tradition. That's right. It was an old tradition. It wasn't actually a currency. Well, apparently the central banks don't agree.
Well, they believe in tradition.
Yes. And they're investing in it very surreptitiously.
Yeah, right.
Well, we're coming on the halfway mark on the show. Why don't we take a break, and then after the break we're going to talk about some of the other things that are not necessarily directly related to the financial situation, but of course all aspects tie into the financial situation. Some of those things we're going to be talking about are Warren Buffett going after the millionaires, or at least attempting to get the government to go after the millionaires. The IRS going after Canadian college students. That should be a really interesting one. Jake's got some really interesting stuff about that one. And plus, Gene's going to be talking about the armed forces, health care, and pensions, and what the implications are with the so-called budget machete. So you'll want to stay tuned for that. This is the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown, here on the Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be right back. Run back to that radio dial. We're back here on the Freedom News Hour. And before we go any further, just want to remind you to check out the website, www.freedomnewshour.com, for all the latest and greatest. And by the way, we do actually have a latest and greatest this week. I don't know if you guys noticed it, but we now have comments available on the various pages. So if you hear us on the air and you want to comment on something that we were talking about, you got your chance. Go to the website, make your comment. If we get enough comments, we may actually get a regular comment page going. So check it out, www.freedomnewshour.com. And as we were talking about before the break, a lot of other things have been going on, including, I still kind of like shake my head as I'm reading this headline, but Jake, is it really true that the IRS is going after Canadian college students?
Well, Mises.org published an article today they called The Attack on Accidental Americans. And what it has to do is with new tax regulations, or I should say existing tax regulations, with the Internal Revenue Service is causing some folks, for instance, Julie Vallot, a college student in Canada, recently just went to the nearest U.S. embassy to renounce her citizenship. She's lived in Canada since she was a young child. She's now 48 years old and had no idea that she was a dual citizen of Canada and the United States. And the IRS was going after her for 10 years of penalties of revenue that she earned while in Canada. and also another person, another Canadian, Carrie Knowles' two teenage daughters, they had no clue that they also became dual citizens at birth. You know, they didn't have passports or anything like that, but they had one American parent, and as such, even though they're born in Canada and spend their whole lives in Canada, they are U.S. citizens. And the IRS contacted them trying to get the money that they earned in Canada from summer jobs. They had hoped to use some of the government plans that they had for educational savings plans to dump in their savings from their summer jobs for college. So the IRS is going after everybody that they possibly can. It doesn't matter if they have ever set foot on U.S. soil. It just doesn't matter.
The penalties that they have is $10,000 per undisclosed assets per year. They are going about trying to destroy all types of bank secrecy. You know, they call this illegal offshore accounts and that sort of thing. But again, a lot of these people, you know, we have 7 million Americans living abroad, and some of these don't even actually realize that they are dual citizens. So they are having to, you know, pay a fee or whatever to renounce their U.S. citizenship. And what's interesting is from the 7 million Americans that live abroad, they've received, the IRS only receives about 400,000 tax returns, which means that only 6% of, only 6% of people are actually complying with taxes. And the whole thing is that things are actually just getting worse. The IRS now, you need to report any financial asset held abroad for over $10,000. And the package that they passed as part of the stimulus plan is that starting in 2013, every bank in the world will be required to report to the IRS all accounts held by current and former U.S. citizens. So if account holders refuse to provide verification that they are not U.S. citizens, the banks will be required to impose a 30% tax of all payments or transfers on the account to the IRS, and banks that do not comply will face withholding on U.S. source interest and dividends and gross proceeds from U.S. securities and pass-through payments. So in other words, they won't be able to trade in U.S. stock markets. The countries of Australia and Japan have already declared their refusal to comply. And Canada's financial minister, Jim Flaherty, has publicly stated that the proposed American legislation has far-reaching extraterritorial implications. It would turn Canadian banks into extensions of the IRS and would raise significant privacy concerns for Canadians, because, again, each Canadian would have to prove that they are Canadians and not U.S. citizens. So it's a pretty silly type of regulation. It's not very reinforceable, but the whole thing is that, you know, from the IRS perspective, they want to take money from people, and they're willing to go about, you know, to whatever lengths that they need to in order to get it.
IRS, it really seizes.
Yeah, I think maybe they need to start calling themselves the International Revenue Service instead of just the internal.
Exactly.
It's just pathetic. I think the part when I read the article that you were referring to, and the part that really got me was when they referred to this Canadian college student's bank account as an illegal offshore account. I mean, first of all, they don't seem to understand that Canada is our northern neighbor. You don't have to go over any kind of water unless you want to kind of cross the Great Lakes.
Yeah, you could, I guess, if you wanted
to. If you really wanted to, you could, but you don't have to in order to go north. But that seems to have bypassed the understanding of the IRS. I don't know, maybe they're just using the term generically. It's hard to tell. The other thing that really caught my attention, though, was the fact that they're trying to, like Jake reported, they're trying to basically use the banks of the world to enable the IRS to collect more and more money for the U.S. government. And that strikes me as a move that's going to just fail dramatically. But on the other hand, if the IRS really tries to do this, if they really try to follow through on this, this could actually turn into something really big in the long run, because basically it means that the IRS doesn't really care so much about where you've actually lived, what you have always believed that your citizenship status is. What really matters is whether or not there's a technical loophole that allows it to seize your money. And, you know, at what point does that start to translate into new ways to come after Americans and American taxpayers? I suspect that this is only the beginning, that we're going to see far more draconian things happening along the way. I mean, Gene, do you see any different?
I'm just amazed. I always assumed, wrongfully, I guess, that if you worked in another country and you lived there, that you would pay taxes to that country. It seems logical, but I suppose.
Well, you pay both. I mean, I lived abroad working as an engineer over abroad in China, and what's funny about it is for a certain amount, you know, technically you're not supposed to pay over a certain amount, but you know, these days the IRS wants everything, so you end up paying.
in both countries. And
so you paid the full rate to both to the U.S. and also to in China. You lived in China, right?
Well, these days I believe you're supposed to. Obviously, if you're living and working in China, China can tax you for that. But I think it's also worth saying that China doesn't really have an income tax unless you're making over a very large amount. So the average person in China has no income tax, which is, you know, supposed to be a communist country. Because, again, one of the other things from the Communist Manifesto is a progressive tax structure where you get taxed more the more you earn. And obviously we've had that for quite a long time here in the U.S.
And how does the Chinese government get their revenue then?
Well, there's other, you know, all the goods that come in and out of the country get taxed. The very rich in China will pay taxes every time you pay electric bills, you know, or any electric bill you pay tax on. There is a lot of times local municipal tax if you own homes, and they have property taxes and that sort of thing. So
that's interesting.
And of course, they can print out money too.
Yeah, that does help.
That's an easy way to do it, right?
And then I think about the Chinese money supply is they don't actually have to report how much of it there is. They don't actually have to participate in something even close to a free market, at least not yet anyway. So you can get away with all kinds of things when you do that.
Right. And, you know, a lot of these small businesses in China just pay cash to people. There's no, you know, like social security numbers where, you know, you're tattooed a number on you that remains on you with birth and you have to keep reporting all the time. There are things, though. I mean, they do try to keep track as best they can, people, and cut off their state pension, in other words, their version of Social Security and medical benefits. But some people just don't care. Like, you know, if you're stuck, and what they try to do is keep people out in, out of the cities up to a certain extent. But a lot of people are so desperate for income that they would rather, you know, work under the table or emigrate and not, you know, lose those particular benefits themselves. So, anyways, for Americans that live abroad, a lot of times you end up paying taxes to the two countries, and when that happens, you find yourself paying so much that you might not feel like working anymore.
Yeah, it's almost not worth it.
Oh, yeah, and you mentioned benefits. Benefits, of course, are a major issue in this country, too, in a number of different ways, including for the armed forces, because their health care and pensions are under attack. And, Gene, what are the details about that?
Yeah, these were long considered untouchable military pensions, and I'll read some from the article. Military pensions and health care for active and retired troops cost the government about $100 billion a year, representing an expanding portion of both the Pentagon budget, which is about $700 billion a year, including war costs, and the national debt, which together finance programs. It goes on to say, if Congress fails to adopt the deficit reduction recommendations of a bipartisan joint congressional committee this fall, the Defense Department will be required under debt ceiling legislation passed in August to find about $900 billion in savings over the coming decade. Cuts that deep will almost certainly entail reducing personal benefits for active and retired troops. It's kind of interesting how it's doled out, though. Under the current rules, service members who retire after 20 years are eligible for pensions that pay half their salaries for life, indexed for inflation, even if they leave at age 38. They're also eligible for lifetime health insurance through the military system, TRICARE, at a small fraction of the cost of private insurance, prompting many working veterans to shun employer health plans in favor of military insurance. And to give you an idea, the annual fee for TRICARE Prime, which is an HMO-like program for military retirees, is $460 for families for the entire year, and it has not risen in years, even as health care costs have skyrocketed. Critics of the system say that contribution could be raised substantially and still be far lower than what civilians pay for employer-sponsored health plans, which is typically about $4,000 a year, which is about 10 times. These critics also argue that under the current rules, 83% of former service members receive no pension payments at all because only veterans with 20 years of service are eligible. Those with 5 or even 15 years are not, even if they did multiple combat tours. Such a structure would be illegal in the private sector, and a company that tried it could be penalized. And, you know, this is interesting because these are the people that are, you know, over in Afghanistan and Iraq, and they serve some time, and then they get out after 4 or 5 years, and they're left with nothing as far as a pension anyway. By far the most contentious proposal circulating in Washington is from a Pentagon advisory panel, the Defense Business Board. It would make military pension system a defined benefit plan, more like a 401k, under which the Pentagon would make contributions to a service member's individual account. Contributions by the troops themselves would be optional. This Leon Panetta has said that if adopted, the plan would not apply to current military personnel. So it's the same thing they were talking about with Social Security, where the current benefactors would not be affected. Last year, for every dollar the Pentagon paid service members, it spent an additional $1.36 for its military retirees, a much smaller group. Even in the troubled world of state and municipal pension funds, pensions almost never cost more than payrolls. Each year, the Defense and Treasury Department set aside more than $75 billion to pay not only current and future benefits, but also pensions for service many years in the past, but the retirement fund has not accumulated nearly enough money to cover its total costs. Where have we heard that before? With assets of $278 billion at the end of 2009 and obligations of $1.4 trillion, so they're a little behind. And of course, and this is the last paragraph, I'm not making this up, the government tries to close the shortfall by simply issuing more Treasury securities each year, thereby adding to the nation's debt.
Yeah, they try to fund all their spending. And, yeah, the Military Retirements Fund is actually a part of the Department of Treasury. And I think what's also interesting, Representative Howard McKeon, a Republican from California, suggested that the spending cuts that they are proposing to the military would cause us to not only slash the number of service members, which is the largest army in the world, 2.3 million people are employed by the armed forces directly, to say nothing of all the military contractors, which is kind of wasted effort, besides defending the border. Exactly. There's nothing economically that you're getting out of, blowing up Afghanistan rocks or what have you. But McKeon is actually stating that he is asking the question of, do we need to reinstate the draft in order to, keep, since the pay is going to be lower, the pensions are going to be lower, do we need to, start forcing young people to serve, which, is going to meet with a lot of outcry from the population, as well as probably also many members in Congress, since drafts is certainly not popular at all. I think like you said, the cuts are going to come somewhere at some point, and the military, and there's some like you mentioned TRICARE and stuff like that. I mean, there are some things, like, for instance, if you're a service member and the government sends you off to war, and you come back with missing limbs or PTSD or all types of medical afflictions, who else is going to be paying for that type of medical care? It really should be the taxpayer, and that should just be another thing that makes the America go to war, only if it were you need to actually defend ourselves.
Defend the borders, yeah. And I saw a quote from Mitt Romney. This was a few weeks ago, where he said he would not cut $1 from the defense budget, which I thought was pretty interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, $1, please.
The other thing that really catches my attention is you were mentioning how the pension is basically under fire. And it's not just military pension. I mean, all kinds of government pensions, private pensions, retirement plans, annuities, all kinds of things are under fire these days because of the bad things going on with the economy. And it's really worth noting that large numbers of these plans, large amounts of the assets, are invested in U.S. Treasuries, which are essentially targeted by what we talked about at the top of the hour, the Fed's Operation Twist, because that Operation Twist is aimed at basically flattening out the yield curve, which means that longer-term treasuries are now worth less. They pay out less. Well, that's got to have an adverse impact on all these various retirement accounts that have been investing in these treasuries, and they're already in trouble. Well, it's going to turn out that Operation Twist is going to put even more pressure on these pension plans and put them even further behind.
Operation Twist Your Arm.
Yeah.
Well, the Fed is basically trying to eliminate all investment opportunities except for just getting rid of your money as fast as possible, whether you're an individual or a, a pension program. You know, they want the money out there being circulated, and they'll do anything to get it done. You know, they think that's the answer, I guess.
Well, they do think that, but they've got to be careful what they wish for, because,
yeah,
like you said, what they're hoping for is everybody to want to get rid of their money. The thing is, if everybody wants to get rid of their money, what it means is the money isn't worth anything anymore, and they're trying to get into something else, and that is hyperinflation.
That's hyperinflation, right.
So you got to be careful what you wish for.
Yeah, it might come true.
It might come true with a vengeance.
Right, that's why it's so important, you know, on days like today that the price of gold and silver does not go up, because if it does go up, or even if it stays the same, people are going, this is going to be that much more apparent that it's a safe haven for folks. So it's, you know, times like these where, there's never a better time to buy, really, because it's exactly what the government does not want you to do.
That's right. That's exactly right. In fact, the fact that it only has dropped, 2 or 3% over the last day or two, compared to everything else basically dropping off the wall, so to speak, it shows very clearly that there is a tremendous amount of demand for gold, even in the midst of a huge sell-off. And the fact that strong demand is there is very significant, despite the fact that major institutional investors have not climbed in. You got to remember that the gold market is a small enough market that if the institutional investors get in, it just will, you know, it'll be basically lighting a fire to the thing.
It's interesting that they haven't. I'm really surprised they don't hold more gold. But I think it's just they look at the long term, price of it and think, they want the quick return, you would think. But I would think they'd still want a certain percentage.
Well, they're also very concerned because for them, remember, most of the people who manage these plans are essentially Keynesian or quasi-Keynesian.
That's
so they
true.
Still buy into the whole crazy economic monetary system ideals.
Well, their job's based on it.
Right, and they basically treat gold as sort of a retreat more than anything else when things get really, really crazy.
Yeah.
But even then, they only do so when they can't get enough treasury.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. They're bought into this whole system, and in these pension plans, we don't really look at what they really are. They're a promise to pay in the future, and in a sense, we can't really pay you now what you're worth or what this is worth. So we'll pay in the future. So it is just a promise, a pension, and that's what they're starting to look like.
And as the banking crisis in Europe continues to unfold, and I think it's probably going to unfold fairly quickly because I believe the German government and the EU have their major meeting coming up at the end of this month, which is just a few days away, where they're going to finally decide once and for all what they're going to do about Greece, what they're going to do about Spain, what they're going to do about Portugal, and so forth. And if that starts to play out the way it's kind of looking like it's going to play out, that could be, it almost certainly will be, very bad for the markets and for the overall confidence of the major market makers that the economy isn't sliding into a recession. That indeed it probably is sliding into recession. As that happens, more and more stocks get sold off, more and more commodities get sold off, more and more people try to go back into treasuries and the U.S. dollar. And that's where the really interesting thing becomes to follow what happens to the price of gold. Because as Jake pointed out, if gold holds its own or even increases, that could be a sign that the U.S. dollar is finally starting to lose its grip on the world economy as the central monetary unit.
Right, and obviously what's going to happen is they're going to be fighting against everything to not have that occur. And there were one of the other things that could be very interesting to watch is tonight there is, I believe it's 9 p.m. Eastern time on Fox News. There will be another Republican debate. This time, Gary Johnson will be included. We've talked about him before. He's been pretty much left out of all the ones previously. Rick Perry, Michelle Bachmann, Mitt Romney, Newt Gingrich, Herman Cain, and Santorum, and John Huntsman, and of course Ron Paul will all attend. So should be a pretty interesting debate.
Well, hopefully it will be. We've got just a few minutes left. One thing that two things I want to touch on. There's actually stuff going on with foreign policy. We should mention these things because they're either rather important. Jake, you have some information about what's been going on in southern Yemen. Why don't you give us a quick summary on that?
Sure. The secret war, or one of the secret wars that the United States continues to fight, because, again, we're still funding the bombing of Libya. U.S. drones today killed another 10 people in southern Yemen, and we're teamed up with the Yemen government to kind of suppress the people there. All of the slain were turned by the Yemen military as al-Qaeda suspects, but when you take a look at what the Yemen government is actually doing, it's certainly not al-Qaeda. Yesterday they declared a ceasefire, but just a couple hours in the capital of Sana'a, they opened fire with mortars on peaceful protesters, killing, I believe, at least 10 more people. So the government, again, the president of Yemen was forced to flee the country. The ceasefire and its violation were just done by the regime, and the protesters, you know, never even really had a chance to comment before they got mortared by the military.
Oh, dear.
So, again, the United States, you know, the U.S. taxpayer is being, you know, is funding these drone strikes, and there is a growing circuit of drone bases popping up all over the Middle East that the CIA and U.S. military is using to bomb.
And supposedly all to go after al-Qaeda. And Gene, there's a real question as to whether or not this is actually a continuation of an ongoing policy, isn't there?
Well, I think it is. White House counter-terror chief John Brennan made some statements at the Harvard Law School, and they related very closely to what was known as the Bush Doctrine, which is a great thing to Google, which was early in the Bush administration. They released a statement. It was a couple pages, and it basically said that the United States could take preemptive strike against countries they thought were a threat to them, and of course they did with the Iraq War and Afghanistan. But anyway, the White House counter-terror chief John Brennan at the Harvard Law School, he says that he laid out what could be called the Osama bin Laden raid doctrine, and he says under international law, the U.S. can protect itself with preemptive action against suspects the U.S. believes present an imminent threat wherever they are, and this basically amounted to a legal defense of seizing the leader of al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden. But you know, this is just a continuation of the same policy, and it's a very different policy from the early non-interventionist policy of the U.S., which is actually very early. You have to go into, you know, the early 1800s. You know, they're just saying we can, basically they're saying we can do whatever we want, although he did add that whenever we want, wherever we want, international legal principles, including respect for state sovereignty and the laws of war, impose important constraints on our ability to act unilaterally. So the words are there, but if they want to do something, they'll do it, as Jake.
Oh, sure. That brings to mind, you know, the words of someone who knew more than a little bit about war, Dwight D. Eisenhower, who was obviously the Supreme Allied Commander in World War II. He later became president, while president said that, quote, preventative war was an invention of Hitler. Frankly, I would not even listen to anyone seriously that came and talked about such a thing. And, you know, soon enough, you know, sure enough, many years later, you have the neoconservatives talking about all this preemptive strikes and all this other really bullcrap that should be, then really is, legal forms of war.
Well, you know, if we did it, you know, you think your neighbor's going to come over and punch you, so you go and punch him. I mean, you get arrested, but when a nation does it, it's you know, preventative, preemptive strike.
Preemptive strike. Oh, good grief. One thing that I was noticing this past week, and of course I'm always following the presidential campaign of Ron Paul, but a lot of attacks on Paul this past week from people who are basically neocon or neocon supporters, absolutely tearing him to pieces over the fact that he wants to, you know, bring some troops home, he wants to cut the defense budget, and so on and so forth. And it makes me wonder, I mean, do these people actually read the headlines about what's going on with the budget? I actually saw one that one person, I don't remember what the person's name was, but it was a columnist who was basically heavily criticizing Paul for even suggesting the idea that we should cut down on our international presence. And he acknowledged that the deficit was there, but he said the whole problem was entitlements.
and that
exactly.
That's where you're supposed to be cutting, that you shouldn't be doing any cutting of defense. And
right, the entitlements that the American people have paid into for many years and are being plundered by the government
in
order
to fund these wars.
That's the whole neocon con, you know, it's that
they
have this small government thing, and that's just so much bull because,
it's not small government, that's the thing. I mean, you and I and Jake, we're all true small government supporters, but we also recognize that you can't just go after entitlements. That's not going to work.
No, exactly. No, they're not, that's what I say, it's just a mirage, you know, they are into big government. They're actually socialists is what they are. They're large scale socialists, and that's all it is when you spend, you know, $1 trillion on defense as far as
I think they're actually socialists would take offense at it. They'd probably say they're more fascist, and I think I tend to agree with them.
Yeah, that's probably a better way to put it.
Yeah.
At any rate, there is some good news. Michelle Bachmann has kind of been fading in the polls, and the person who's been rising in the polls that the media hasn't really been talking about is Ron Paul. Nationally, in a lot of polls, he is a very strong third place at 13, 14, 15%. Following Perry and Romney, and in the state of New Hampshire, he's pulling strong second to Romney. So he's actually impressing me as the slow and steady guy in this GOP race. So we'll see how that works out.
The one thing I can say for Paul's numbers is that once he gains them, he doesn't seem to lose them. Other candidates, you know, their fortunes may rise and their fortunes may fall. But as Ron Paul gains supporters, they tend to be, I don't know, tenacious is perhaps the word. They are a very solid backing. They may not be huge numbers yet, but they're a very solid foundation.
They don't go away, that's right. And it's funny because they were talking about a three-person race when Michelle Bachmann was there, but now that she's fallen down and Ron Paul's in third place, now it's a two-person race.
Oh, of course, because he's the only one who actually wants to cut the defense budget.
Yes.
Right. And next week he'll be appearing on Comedy Central with Jon Stewart for the first time since his 2012 race started. So much looking forward to some comedy relief when that occurs.
Well, we've reached the end of the hour, but, gentlemen, it's been a pleasure as usual.
Yes, it has. Thanks, you guys.
And we'll see
everybody survive meltdown.
That's right. And we'll see you all next week on the Freedom News Hour, Surviving Meltdown. Goodbye, everybody.